طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. The unwillingness of the United States to push back against the illegal and outrageous plundering of Palestinian land and property by Israel simply encourages the continuation of such activity. And the unwillingness of the Western media to accurately report these violations of international law exposes their complicity in this blatant property theft. There simply is no other word for it. We see it constantly, but the following story this past week reported by the Middle East Monitor takes the cake. The Monitor reports, and I quote from the article, "Some 790 Palestinian firms based in occupied Jerusalem are being transferred to Jewish ownership," Jordanian newspaper Al Gad has reported. Director of the Maps and Survey Department in the Orient House in Jerusalem, Khalil Al-Tafakshi, said, "These properties are owned by Arab-Palestinian families, including 595 residential apartments, and 186 shops. The Israeli occupation confiscated these firms in 1968, turned them into state property, and now it is turning them into private ownership by Jewish settlers." Al-Tafakshi stressed, "The recent Israeli announcement to build new settlement units in occupied Jerusalem was a step towards turning Palestinian properties over to Jewish settlers." He noted that the Israeli occupation does not hide its occupation and settlement plans. The Israeli president and prime minister reiterated that Jerusalem, east and west, is a united city for the Jewish nation, and it would remain the eternal united capital for them. According to Al-Tafakshi, the recent ongoing Israeli measures regarding the so-called absentee property law is the Israeli tool used to target Palestinian properties owned by Palestinians living outside Jerusalem. Using this law, the occupation is targeting the remaining 13% of occupied Jerusalem controlled by Palestinians, he said. Unquote. In the United States, we adore private property. The privatization of all things public is well underway here, including the privatization of water. In Israel, there is a new wrinkle. Here is the drill. Take over Palestinian property using the absentee property law. Never mind that the Palestinians are not absent. They are just, well, declared absent. And then the Israeli state takes over the property and then turns around and sells the property to Jewish settlers. Grand theft in anyone's book. And our government cheers it on. Unbelievable. Except it is not. Other stories out of Palestine this week. Israeli troops invaded on Monday at dawn the village of Al-Qawm, near the southern West Bank city of Hebron, and ordered villagers to remove the power grid there. According to villagers, the soldiers gave them military orders to remove the 800 meters long power line supplying the village homes with electricity. The Israeli army claims that the lines are in Area C and was installed too close to the separation wall that was built by Israel on lands confiscated from the villagers. And from the north, Palestinian medical sources have reported that 10 residents, including children, have been injured when Israeli soldiers invaded on Tuesday at dawn in Jaba, a town south of the northern West Bank city of Jenin. The number of military vehicles invaded the town, broke into and searched a few homes, and interrogated several families. Soldiers also searched old caves in the town and around it. The invasion led to clashes with local youths who hurled stones in the invading vehicles, while the soldiers fired several rounds of live ammunition, gas bombs, and concussion grenades. At least 10 Palestinians, including children, suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation and received treatment by local medics. On Monday at night, the Palestinian District Coordination Office managed to secure the release of a 14-year-old Palestinian child a few hours after Israeli soldiers kidnapped him. The office contacted the Israeli District Coordination Office directly after the family informed it of the abduction and conducted extensive efforts that eventually led to his release. On Tuesday, May 26th, less than 2 weeks after Omar al-Shalabi's 9-month prison sentence over posts on Facebook, Israeli authorities have revoked his wife's residency status in East Jerusalem. Muna Abdullah al-Shalabi has been living in East Jerusalem since she and her husband's marriage 23 years ago. Al-Shalabi has recently had her residency status in Jerusalem revoked after her husband's 9-month sentence to an Israeli prison. The Israeli Ministry of the Interior refused her residency by citing unspecified security reasons. She has been ordered to leave Jerusalem. Israeli authorities say that al-Shalabi had the chance to defend herself and her application in February, but never came forward, so the application was refused. Al-Shalabi denied that she had ever been given the chance to defend the application. Muna and Omar al-Shalabi have 6 children together. Hundreds of East Jerusalem Palestinians have their residency revoked by Israel authorities every year. Regardless of the situation, no Palestinian status in the city is ever guaranteed. It is through these kinds of methods that Israel continues its ethnic cleansing and attempts to drive Palestinians out of Jerusalem so that it can take over the entire city. Stories like these are reported every week by Palestinian news sources. These daily atrocities are the fiber of existence in most Palestinian communities. They are never reported in the Western media, which is why occasionally we have to remind our listeners of what life is like under occupation. Our featured presentation this morning is a speech by Hanan Eshwari, given to the Holy Land Ecumenical Foundation at their annual convention in November of 2014. For a long time, we have wanted to have Hanan Eshwari on this week in Palestine, and this morning we do. Hanan Eshwari is a Palestinian legislator, activist, and scholar. Eshwari was an important leader during the First Intifada, served as the official spokesperson for the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace process, and has been elected numerous times to the Palestinian Legislative Council. She is the first woman elected to the Palestinian National Council. Here is Palestinian legislator, activist, and spokesperson, Hanan Eshwari.
Thank you, Rateb. Thank you, everybody. You have powers of endurance, or you're gluttons for punishment. I thought you'd have enough by last night. I was asked to speak today about trying to frame the current issues in Palestine, but as always, nothing is just current in Palestine. Everything is either connected contextually to the past or connected to the future, so things are in a state of flux. It's a pleasure to always to participate in your events. they are always significant and effective, and you do make a difference. It also provides us with an opportunity to meet so many wonderful people, some of whom, you know, are old friends, people I have known for a long time, and there are many whom I've lost touch with, but I'm very happy to reconnect. We are not only reconnecting, but we are shaping a joint discourse and a comprehensive vision of a future of dignity, of freedom for Palestine and for Palestinians everywhere. Right now, we and the rest of the world are still trying to come to grips with the impact, as I told you yesterday, of the horrific assault on Gaza, the aftermath of the devastation and the carnage that was inflicted in Israel's latest assault. In a series of massacres and the deliberate and willful destruction of lives, of homes, of institutions, of infrastructure, of factories, and whole neighborhoods. The most basic requirements of life have been destroyed, pulverized, including things like water, things like waste disposal, things like basic shelter. And the ramifications of such deliberate destruction are to be felt for a very long time. As you know, Gaza has already been, as I said, under siege. It's been in a state of total deprivation and suffering for a very long time. And to have a people who are imprisoned, 1.8 million people, who are helpless, victims, being shelled and bombed and pounded to smithereens, and then for Israel to claim that this is self-defense is just beyond any logic, beyond any moral dimension that people can accept. It is, of course, a tragedy and a humanitarian disaster of enormous proportions. And I don't think people have yet understood or internalized the immensity of the crime of what happened in Gaza. And as I said yesterday, it's not just numbers and abstractions. It's very real. Even people like Ban Ki-moon, who went to Gaza a few days back, came out and said that he hadn't... I mean, all the reports, all the images, all the films, all the stills, everything that he'd seen about the devastation of Gaza were nothing compared to what he actually saw, did not prepare him for the degree of suffering and destruction. And that is only Gaza. It's a place where only heartbreak thrives, and constant victimization. And it's not the first time that Gaza has been assaulted. This assault is not only, some people say it's a field of experimentation where Israel tries its latest weaponry in Gaza. But it's also an attempt to destroy the national unity, to also destroy any kind of reconciliation or building a national system in Palestine, and an attempt to detach Gaza from the West Bank and destroy the chances of peace, frankly speaking. And in the meantime, the ongoing assault on the West Bank, yesterday I described it as a hemorrhage. It is. It's a sort of daily, systematic, destructive attempt that seeks to colonize the West Bank as a whole. It's an aggression, but it's an aggression that's not very dramatic and that's not very visible, because it's taking place quietly, willfully, deliberately, without much fanfare, and therefore without much attention, but with really devastating effects and impact, especially when it comes to Jerusalem. We're seeing an increase. You know that Jerusalem is besieged by a triple siege. I always talk about this to remind people that Palestinians cannot go to Jerusalem. If you're a West Banker or a Gazan, you cannot enter your own city. And it is besieged by, first of all, checkpoints, military checkpoints, and then by a whole ring, or now there are double and triple rings of settlements, and the latest by the horrible apartheid wall. And this wall not only besieges Gaza, but Jerusalem, It also separates Palestinian from other Palestinians. It is not a wall between Palestine and Israel like many people think. Those of you who are there, who've been there, know that. It is mainly on Palestinian territory, and it steals our horizon. It steals our ability to see the sunlight. And there's nothing worse than stealing people's horizon. But I keep telling the Israelis, when you build this horrible wall, it's not just a wall of separation and annexation, you are also imprisoning yourselves behind the wall. And walls historically have been a failed policy, haven't they? From the Great Wall of China, to Hadrian's Wall, to the Berlin Wall. And this wall will collapse as well. But what is even more destructive is the deliberate policy of ethnic cleansing in Area C and in Jerusalem. Israelis get very upset when we use terms like ethnic cleansing or like genocide or like war crimes and massacres. And I tell them, if the word disturbs you, you should see how the action affects us. If you don't like the word, then don't do it. If you don't like being described as a country that commits war crimes or ethnic cleansing, then stop committing war crimes and ethnic cleansing, and we won't use the language, the terms. It's the action itself that is the significant part. They're evacuating Area C, and they are evacuating Jerusalem. Those of you who have Jerusalem IDs know what it means, to be at the mercy of your occupier, where they have legislated these draconian laws that violate international law in order to confiscate or revoke Palestinian IDs from Jerusalem in order to empty out the city. And this is happening regularly. Now, close to 15,000 Palestinian IDs have been revoked, have been confiscated from Jerusalem, because they legislate that if you're not even a Palestinian citizen, they say. You're not even a citizen of Jerusalem. You have, when Israel occupied Jerusalem, they turned everybody into temporary residents. They call it permanent residency, but temporary residence. And then they legislated laws where you have to prove that you are living in Jerusalem. How? You have to stay in Jerusalem. You cannot leave Jerusalem for any reason. My daughter's left to study abroad. But if you leave Jerusalem for more than 3 years, you lose your ID. They confiscate it. So you have no rights. You have no ability. You have no right to come back to Palestine and live in Jerusalem, even if you're going outside to study. You have to prove that Jerusalem is the center of your life. You have to send your children to schools in Jerusalem. But they don't give you permits to build schools in Jerusalem. There's a severe shortage of classrooms for Palestinians in Jerusalem. So you send your children to schools outside Jerusalem. Jerusalem is no longer the center of your life. Again, hospitals, again, trade. Most economic activity in Jerusalem is going outside the wall, outside Jerusalem, because of the siege. And so they say, if you work outside Jerusalem, you go outside, it means Jerusalem is no longer the center of your life. The center of life argument. I'd like to see this applied to non-Palestinians. I'd like to see this applied not to Christians and Muslims, but to Jews as well. Israeli Jews can have multiple citizenships, can live wherever they want, can travel wherever they want. If a Palestinian gets a residency, if you're a Palestinian Jerusalemite, you get a green card in the U.S., you lose your residency in Jerusalem. This is ethnic cleansing. This is what happens when Israel is attempting to change not just the demographic character of the city, but also the cultural character, the physical character, the geographic character, the siege of the city, drying it up, and then implanting in Jerusalem settlements and settlers and organizations and institutions in the Old City and in East Jerusalem. This is a deliberate and willful distortion of the history and the culture and the character of a city that is so much greater than itself and so much greater than the greed of the Israeli occupier. But this is happening, and now I'm afraid you have to pay attention to what's happening in Al-Haram al-Sharif, in Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's extremely dangerous. Every day you have settlers coming into the compound of Al-Haram Sharif. Every day you have clashes. You have now, again, military orders preventing Palestinians from praying in the mosque. If they're younger than 60, they close off the mosque at will. The army, the border guards and the police enter the mosque regularly. There are clashes ongoing. And gradually they are going to take over this holiest of places, not just for the Muslims, but for humanity as a whole. This is cultural heritage. It's for humanity everywhere. Israel is giving itself the right to claim all religious sites on the basis of their holy significance. This is a crusader mentality, anyway. The last time we had people waging war because certain places were sacred was during the Crusades, right? As an excuse to exercise sovereignty on other people. Sovereignty is an issue that is political and legal. It is not religious. Otherwise, the whole world would be in a mess. But anyway, I'm just telling you that the Al-Aqsa Mosque, Al-Haram al-Sharif, are in danger. And we have to pay attention to what Israel is doing. It's a deliberate policy. Jerusalem is in danger. And I believe we have to try to do whatever is possible to rescue Jerusalem from the greed of acquisition and transformation and forgery that is taking place. But Israel is systematically superimposing greater Israel on historical Palestine. And I've always said, if Israel is destroying the two-state solution, the answer is not a one-state solution, because that is going to be a de facto outcome, and it's going to be extremely painful and difficult. I think my response to anybody who wants to create greater Israel is to demand historical Palestine, very simply. Now, what is happening is part of an ongoing, and as I said, a sinister pattern of, and a persistent pattern of behavior in an overall system of control, of power politics, of enslavement, which is summed up in the term Israeli occupation of Palestine. And for too long, Israel has been allowed to enjoy impunity, has been exempt from any kind of accountability, and has claimed a sense of entitlement, exceptionalism, and privilege. And now it can do anything it wants, claiming self-defense. It is the first time in history where an occupier is claiming self-defense from its own victims. That you can do whatever you want to a captive, helpless, defenseless population, and should they react, then not only do you pull out a convenient label, the post-it of terrorist, and we are all branded, you know, terrorists if we react to the Israeli oppression, but also Israel claims self-defense from its own victims. And unfortunately, you get lots of people, including people in the administration, who keep parroting this idea of self-defense. Since when does a military occupation claim self-defense from its victims? Since when? And since when, I said this earlier, do you ask a people under occupation to guarantee the safety and security of their occupier? This, again, is beyond logic. But the whole situation is not just entirely illogical, it's entirely immoral and inhuman and extremely cruel. And, of course, Israel has a very convenient way of blaming the victim all the time, just through a process of dehumanization, of demonization. If you hear Netanyahu's speech, and we'll talk about this later, about how he's lumped everybody together, Hamas, Boko Haram, he says, Daesh, Al-Qaeda, everybody, ISIS, they're all the same. And he divided the world into, you know, the good and evil. It reminds me of the older days when George Bush talked about a Manichaean universe of good and evil. And so everybody who's not like Netanyahu and his ilk is evil, including the whole Muslim world, regardless. And this kind of branding this kind of demonization, this kind of lumping together everybody and sort of saying they're the enemy and therefore it's perfectly legitimate to kill and to destroy and do whatever you want and wage wars on terrorism because you've labeled and dehumanized your victim. This is the kind of effort that succeeded historically in giving Israel license to kill and giving Israel immunity from accountability. But it's no longer the case now. I think people are beginning to see through such arguments, and we will talk about this later. There are transformations, however small or maybe imperceptible, but they are building up. And Israel no longer has a monopoly on the public discourse, on the public domain. What's happening within Israel and this attempt at demonization and creating a Manichaean universe is generating a culture of hate within Israel, a culture of racism, a culture of violence, and such a culture is certainly not conducive to a just peace. There is a systematic erosion of values, along with the rejection of any kind of accountability or any kind of respect for a global rule of law or a global legal system. Now, ever since the Nakba, even before that, I was telling the Brits that the debate in Parliament is long overdue about, I'm sure you've heard about this, about recognizing Palestine. We're very happy it happened, even though it is non-binding, but it's the beginning of the process of rectification we talked about. Ever since 1917 and the Balfour Declaration, and 1947-48 and the British Mandate and the withdrawal of the Mandate without Palestinian self-determination, I feel not just the Brits, but the whole world owes us something. Because I believe there is international complicity, if not duplicity, when it comes to Palestine. You have one country that is given preferential treatment, that is exempt from abiding by international law, international humanitarian law and human rights conventions and requirements, and you have one nation, one people, who are totally deprived of the protection of the law and who are left at the mercy of their occupier. And we can talk about all the different ramifications and the whole cycle and the whole language accompanying this kind of asymmetry. But this injustice has to be rectified. We have not just a double, we have multiple injustices. It takes too long to talk about them. And yesterday I said, I don't know which is worse, living under occupation and a ruthless military regime or living in exile as refugees or expats, refugees primarily at the mercy of host countries who don't really want them. Or even the Palestinian indigenous population in historical Palestine, what we call Israel in 1948 Palestine, who are subject to the most intricate system of discrimination. Legal discrimination, educational, historical, we mustn't forget them. There are about 1.5 million now Palestinians in Israel who are, again, victims of Israeli racism and violence. And it's not just the price tag people who are targeting them and targeting Jerusalem, but this culture of hate and violence and so on is generating acts that are extremely destructive. And they are threatening the lives and well-being of the Palestinians everywhere. There are, of course, as I said, encouraging signs, not just the debate in the UK Parliament. I am really happy that we saw 274 votes yes and 12 votes no, and across all the parties. But I'm also discouraged that the government said, well, this is not binding and there is no change in government policy. Well, if you don't listen to your own public opinion and you don't listen to your own parliament, you listen only to Israel or to the Americans maybe. Again, Sweden announced that it's going to recognize Palestine. This is encouraging as well. And now we're seeing Spain and Ireland and so on talking about moving. Another encouraging aspect was the guidelines that the EU adopted pertaining to settlement products and pertaining to cooperation with institutions and organizations and cultural exchange and scientific institutions that have any dealings with the settlements. And I think gradually there will be a larger movement that would hold Israel accountable when it comes to economic exchange. Because Israel, by the way, is in violation of the EU policies and EU legislation, especially pertaining to the association agreement, Article 2 of those of you who follow these things, Article 2 of association agreement with the EU in particular talks about human rights violations. And the Europeans know very well what's happening, how Israel is systematically violating the rights of the Palestinians everywhere. Now, that's why after Gaza we said it is time, instead of dealing with the latest Israeli violation, with the latest Israeli aggression, we have to deal with the causes, with the totality of the injustice suffered by the Palestinian people. Otherwise, this pattern will persist. And the next couple of years, we'll see another attack on Gaza and another massacre and another series of destructive acts and so on, while systematically Israel is swallowing up the West Bank through a series of settlements, land confiscation and so on, home demolitions, evictions. Area C is being evacuated. It's 62% of Palestine. And that's something that really makes me angry. Those who signed agreements transforming Palestine. I said we used to inhabit a land that has names of places of historical, religious, human significance. And when they signed agreements, we found ourselves inhabiting letters of the alphabet, A, B, and C. This is Palestine, you guys. This is not areas A, B, and C. But area C, under Israeli military control, constitutes 62% of the West Bank. And Israel is busy evicting the people of Area C in order to annex Area C. And that's what they're saying. They're saying the Palestinians can have their own population centers, can have self-rule and so on, but we need Area C for our own security. Actually, they're investing, they are using Area C as a source of great economic profit, by the way, because the Jordan Valley is in Area C as well. So anyway, what they're doing, in a sense, is destroying the chances of peace, and we mustn't continue. We mustn't just deal with the latest violation. This is something Israel is good at doing. It draws you into tangential issues, side issues, the latest violation. It's like having, you know, thousands of little fires everywhere that you are unable to put down. So you lose track, you lose sight of the major issue, the fact that there is a systematic and deliberate destruction of the state of Palestine in order to build greater Israel. This is what Ilan Pape, and I keep telling people, read that book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. This is what's happening, the displacement and replacement paradigm that he's talking about. Displace a whole nation with its history, with its culture, with its identity, replace it with another, even steal the names. If you've seen settlements being built next to villages, Palestinian villages and towns, you notice that the names of the settlements are very close to the Arabic names. There's a competition over the history, as though they were there before us, or they were there along with us. Even the naming is a tool. Even the theft of our cuisine. That's something that drives me nuts. I'm sure it drives you nuts too, right? When you read about, you know, Israeli falafel and Israeli hummus and Israeli tabbouleh, and you know, recently I was reading about the latest Israeli health food, frike. I can't believe this. I mean, you've confiscated our land. You've tried to confiscate our utterance. Now you're confiscating our culture, including our cuisine, our food, historically. I mean, this is amazing. So they are, in a sense, taking over the Palestinian reality, to digest it and turn it into an Israeli reality and to compete over legitimacy and the historical discourse, the historical narrative. That's what's so dangerous. And there are many people who believe them because they started with a myth, the land without a people for a people without a land, and they're continuing this myth by manufacturing all sorts of ideologies. I have to stop. Yes, okay. Look, I have about 15 more pages, but I will be glad to answer questions. But let me tell you one thing.
Don't stop.
I get orders from a higher authority.
No, she wants to hear you.
For question and answer, still we have some time. You know, that's what I'm hoping that...
Okay, but let me talk about... Yes, we will have question and answer. We'll have a discussion now. The introduction of the ideological component into the political and legal realities is very dangerous. That's why Israel is so persistently asking us to become Zionists. We all have to accept the Jewishness of the state. We in Palestine have always been pluralistic, tolerant, inclusive. We've never discriminated on the basis of religion, ethnicity, maybe gender, but we're fighting that. And to be told that the things we are fighting against in our own society, we have to accept in Israel, an exclusive state for Jews only. We have to become Zionists in order to qualify to have a state or to make peace or even to talk to Israel, this is unacceptable. And you don't make peace with ideology. You make peace on the basis of legality as a political process and on the basis of international law. But if you want my ideology versus your ideology, we won't get anywhere. So that's another reason. Last night I talked about the open-ended peace process and the open-ended occupation. I just want to mention this before I end because I think we are in danger of seeing a repetition of another cycle of peace talks. The problem is that negotiations have become a flawed process and an open process. The negotiating or what is called the peace process. Since 1991, actually we started before 91, but very few people know about that history. We've been talking endlessly, and Israel has bought more time to create more facts and has gained more cover, legal cover, in order to continue with its settlement expansion and annexation of Jerusalem. And every time there's a new initiative to talk, they keep repeating the mistakes of the previous cycle of talks. And what do you call it when you keep doing the same thing over and over and over again, hoping for a different result? It's insanity, exactly. And I keep telling the Americans, I came on the same plane as John Kerry day before yesterday. You can't keep doing the same thing over and over again and hope for a different result. Either the U.S. should have the courage to stand up to Israel, to respect international law, to stop settlement activities, to get Israel to accept the terms of reference that we agreed to 25 years ago, to accept, to honor its commitments and obligations as per the signed agreements, or we're not going to get anywhere. Not only that, but we're going to regress. The situation is becoming much more dangerous because Israel is given time and space to continue to destroy the two-state solution, to continue to violate international law, and to continue to claim the sense of privilege and entitlement and exceptionalism, that it can live outside the law and beyond any type of accountability. But without the two components that I've always talked about, accountability for Israel and protection for the Palestinians, without recognizing parity before the law, before international law, there can be no peace. And peace is not just trying to hammer the Palestinians into submission. People who've tried that before know that it cannot happen. We're not an easy people to control or to tame or to bring us to our knees. We are a people who know what our rights are and we are committed to them. And if we made the historical compromise of accepting the 67 boundaries, of accepting 22% of historical Palestine, we didn't do this out of weakness. We did this out of confidence that we are shaping a future for our children. But if Israel destroys that very chance, then it is destroying the chances of peace for a very long time to come. And it will continue to feed extremism and violence throughout the region and even beyond. I will stop here. And don't worry, we will have an open and candid discussion, I hope,
okay,
on issues of your own concern.
You know how...
That was Palestinian legislator, activist, and spokesperson Hanan Eshwari speaking to the convention of the Holy Land Ecumenical Foundation in November 2014. And finally, we know the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is sticking in the craw of Israel when it pressures the U.S. Congress to outlaw the movement. That is precisely what is happening at both the federal and state level as we speak. In Congress, Democrats and Republicans are trying to attach an anti-boycott bill to a mega trade deal involving Europe and the United States. In Tennessee and Indiana, state officials have passed a resolution criticizing the boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS movement as anti-Semitic. And in Illinois, state legislators look set to approve an anti-BDS law requiring state pensions to divest funds from companies that boycott or divest from Israel. It all adds up to a sustained attack on the BDS movement in the United States. The methods differ. Some are mere resolutions expressing an opinion, while others have teeth. But they are all united in seeking to stigmatize the BDS movement as beyond the pale. The moves are part of a nationwide effort to halt a movement that has had symbolic success on college campuses and some concrete success in forcing foundations and churches to divest from corporations that do business with the Israeli military. BDS has not succeeded in isolating Israel. But pro-Israel officials in the United States want to stop it before it gets close to harming the state. The congressional initiative, backed by the influential American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, APAC, has attracted the most attention. In February, Representatives Peter Roskam, a Republican from Illinois, and Juan Vargas, a California Democrat, introduced the Israel Trade and Commercial Enhancement Act. It is designed to be attached to the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership, a major free trade deal with the European Union. The legislation would require the United States to discourage European trade partners from boycotting Israel products, even if they are made in the West Bank settlements, products that the EU nations have targeted. The amendment has passed committees in the House and Senate. Earlier this week, Senate Democrats held up moving forward on the trade deal votes. But a day later, the Senate struck a deal with Obama to allow votes on a number of trade-related bills, paving the way for the EU trade deal to be debated and voted on eventually, BDS amendments included. The measures have been harshly criticized by activists for Palestinian rights. Writing in The Hill, Jewish Voice for Peace's Naomi Dan said the bill would legislate support for Israel's illegal settlements and would impede efforts to apply nonviolent pressure on Israel to change its discriminatory policies towards Palestinians. Liberal Zionist groups opposed to BDS are also opposed to the congressional effort because of the legislative language that would, at first, put the U.S. government on record as recognizing Israeli control of the West Bank. Meanwhile, state-level efforts targeting the BDS movement are moving ahead. The Tennessee House and Senate have passed a resolution that declares the BDS movement to be one of the main vehicles for spreading anti-Semitism and advocating the elimination of the Jewish state. The Indiana House and Senate have passed a similar resolution. The Indiana bill has been harshly criticized by a coalition of groups including the National Lawyers Guild, Palestine Solidarity Legal Support, and Jewish Voice for Peace. While ostensibly opposing anti-Semitism, it erroneously conflates criticism of Israeli policies and practices toward Palestinians with hatred of Jewish people, the coalition wrote in a letter to Indiana Governor Mike Pence, who was expected to sign the bill. In its intolerance for political advocacy that it clearly misunderstands, the resolution threatens to chill protected speech by intimidating people who wish to criticize Israel's behavior toward Palestinians. The Illinois measure on state pensions, which has passed the state Senate, is now being debated in the House. This measure, like the congressional one, is a law with some teeth. The legislation requires pension funds to stop investing money in foreign companies that have boycotted Israel. In a statement, Palestine Solidarity Legal Support said that the bill forces pension fund administrators to blacklist companies that boycott Israel or businesses that operate in territories under the control of Israel. Illinois should not be shielding Israel from boycotts, protesting human rights abuses and settlements, which are illegal under international law in what is considered occupied territory by the United States government. These efforts are looking to be more successful than the previous wave of anti-boycott bills that were debated after the American Studies Association voted to boycott Israel in late 2013. Many of those bills did not get support from pro-Israel lobby groups because of concerns over academic freedom and free speech. This crop of legislation has garnered more support from traditional bastions of pro-Israel advocacy. After an Illinois committee passed the anti-BDS bill, the Jewish group B'nai B'rith International applauded the state representatives in a statement for, quote, taking such a strong stance against a movement rooted in anti-Semitism that ultimately impedes the peace process by opposing constructive dialogue between Israel and Palestinians, unquote. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.